My name is Gilda Miros, and I am at the Carol Lynn Maillard's flat, her apartment. And it's Friday, the 16th of March, 2018. I have the pleasure of capturing some of her life in audio. So we will be talking with Carol, and you'll have the pleasure of knowing a little bit more about this star. We who believe in freedom. Sweet honey in the rock, still on the journey. I am looking at an extraordinary, unique book. And there's an important chapter about Carol Maillard, or Carol Lynn, as I read that she was as a child. We will know a little more. Thank you for giving us this interview, this oral history, Carol. Tell me about this book.
Well, when I came back to Sweet Honey in the Rock as a full-time member, because I had been a substitute singer, I had left the group for a long time and been in New York doing my career, and they had a need for someone to come back in as a full-time member. And the first time they asked me, I said, no, it's not something that I could do. I want to do right now. And then it came back to me again. And I sought advice from various people. And they said, well, if it's coming to you again, and it's not going to interfere with your family life, raising your son, it's going to give you a few dollars on a consistent basis, think about it, do it. Maybe it's something that you could actually do. So I came back in 1992, and they were writing this book, and I had already started my chapter because I'm one of the founding members of the group.
You are an inspiration.
Thank you.
For them. You're a composer.
Yes.
You are a singer. And you're a violin virtuoso.
Oh, I used to be. That many, many moon ago.
Well, tell me about the moves back there.
Okay.
The child saw the violin for the first time.
You know, when I had originally gone into my high school's rooms. We had these little rooms for clubs you wanted to be in. And I had gone to the chorus because I always wanted to sing. I wasn't thinking about any instrumentation. And then one of my best friends at the time said, Carol, listen, don't sign up for Glee Club. Come get in the orchestra. All of our friends are in the orchestra. And guess what? You won't have to go to detention. If you get in trouble, the nuns will get you out because you have to go to rehearsal. And I was like, that sounds pretty good. Not that I thought I would ever need to be in detention. But I said, sister, I'm going to go, because it was a Catholic girls' high school, go and sign up for orchestra. Now, when I went into the room and sat down, I saw my friends, various schools in the North Philadelphia area, Catholic grade schools. And she said, play violin. We're going to all play violin. And the nun came by, Sister Giovanni. First person I would say who mentored me or looked out for me. And she said, looking at my lips and feeling my face and jaw, she said, French horn. And I said, sister, I'd like to play violin. And she said, then she started my fingers and whatever. And she said, okay. Sister Miriam put her in violin. And from that point, I realized that I had to go for 6 weeks in the summertime for school time lessons. And something about that instrument just really struck me. I don't know what it was. I know destiny, whatever, but I came to love it very, very much.
And you learned right away?
I didn't learn like right away because we didn't have private lessons. We had group lessons. So all the freshmen played together and the sophomore, you know what I mean? And depending on your class, you had your lessons with Sister Giovanni together. And if you were fortunate, you got a violin of your own some way and you got private lessons or whatever. But in school, they were group lessons.
That's what we did. Were you able to get a violin?
When I was 16, my father bought me a
16.
Violin. He bought me it's a little broke up. It's in the house somewhere. But, yes, he bought me my very own violin. That was, I cannot tell you how major that was for me, growing up in North Philadelphia, going to a huge all-girls high, Catholic girls high school, being African-American and playing first violin and being left sitting when Sister Giovanni left. She put us all in our positions, and she put me in the first seat. And that was a problem for the girls that were already there, because they felt like somebody else should have had that seat. So they weren't very cooperative with me.
Did you come from a musical family?
No, not really, no. I come from a very, I don't want to say dysfunctional, but challenged family scenario. My mother, unfortunately, got hooked on heroin when I was about 2.5, 3 years old. They were all hanging out at the jazz clubs, my father and all of their crew, and they were trying different things. And my mother was the only one that got, what would you say, hooked?
Mm-hmm. She addicted.
Was addicted. She was out of all of them. She was the only one that had a sensitive system and got addicted.
And you had other brothers?
No, I'm an only child. But between my mother and father, I'm the only child.
Did that affect you?
Well, I think it did because there was so much noise. There became a lot of noise in the house and arguing and stealing. And
you were aware?
Oh, wow, absolutely, because it's noise. My grandmother's yelling. My cousin is, you know, nervous about everything. My aunt comes over. My mother is like, I don't know what you're talking about. And then finally, I think what ended up happening was that my father, my mother told me this story, how my father ended up going to prison, was that he was so nervous because in that time, that's the Billie Holiday go to jail. You know, everybody went to jail for it. And they didn't want mommy to have to go to jail. So they scooped her up, sent her back to Baltimore after my father tried to rob a small store so he could get money. And my parents were just regular nice people, right? Nice, pretty people who loved jazz and looked good and dressed up and took care of me and all of that kind of stuff.
How did you land in Catholic school?
We lived, the fence in the back was between my house and a family of eight, and they all went to Catholic school. And when my grandmother had to go to hospital, they took care of me. And they said, you should put Lenny in, my middle name, Lenny, you should put Lenny in parochial school. Okay, well, my father ended up getting incarcerated, trying to help my mother, who had become addicted to heroin. And everyone was quite afraid because she would have been put in jail. My father didn't know what else to do. He went to try to get some money and ended up going to prison for 5 years. My mother was taken off to Baltimore to family to try and get her rehabbed. They didn't have that word then, but to help her. And through whatever circumstances, my mother ended up in New York with some people, and became a New Yorker. And I guess led her life on the streets, in the jazz clubs, doing her thing. And we didn't really always know where she was. When my father came home from prison, and I did communicate with him, I wrote letters and he wrote back. And when he finally came home, I knew I had an ally. My Aunt Lucille was my mother's sister, and she took really good lookout care for me because I was what I call a twirler. I was always in the house twirling and making up songs and playing the piano and singing and driving. My grandmother, who was raising me, drove her crazy because it was just too much energy for her. But however, my Aunt Lucille knew I wanted to be an actress because I had always said it. I want to be on the stage. I would say it out loud. Lenny, what do you want to be when you grow up? I want to be an actress. Oh, okay. Nobody knew how to help me be an actress as a little kid. You need to be a teacher.
How did you get to college?
I studied violin in high school. Like I said in the very beginning, I ended up in the violin program at John W. Hallahan, but I also ended up co-concertmeister and student conductor. And I had my own little group after school, and we would be improvising and making up music and playing sheet music and doing things like that after orchestra rehearsal. They would let us stay until 5 o'clock, and we would make up stuff for a half an hour and then say, see you tomorrow.
You're a happy child.
No, I wasn't. I was disturbed. I was depressed. I was disturbed. But that but the performance element and my sense of humor and my friends kept me kind of uplifted. There was a lot of sadness. There was really a lot of regret. My father ended up getting incarcerated again, so that was a big hole in my life. My grandmother died, which released me from...
You were old.
I was 14, and when she died, my life opened up because she was very strict and strident. Yeah, she didn't want me to turn out like my mother. I had no intention of turning out like my mother because I knew what my mother was about. I wanted to be an actress. That's all I knew, is that I wanted to be an actress. So my father was supportive. When he finally came back home, you know, my father and my aunt, they kept me kind of sane, but I was still troubled, you know, by the sadness of when my father wasn't there or where is my mother. Oh, yeah, and then my mother ends up in federal prison in Alderson, West Virginia. Okay. Whew, boy.
How does a child deal with that?
It's shame. It's shame. That's the best word I can come up with.
And the music was your therapy?
I would say so. I played, I studied, I practiced. Like I said, when my father came home and started, you know, really trying to help take care of me in many, many, many ways, he bought me a violin for my 16th birthday, and they paid for my violin, private violin lessons, because I was doing good. I was playing well.
When did you start composing?
I didn't start composing until my sophomore year of college. I went to Catholic University of America on a violin performance scholarship. And when I was, you know, we had a piano in my dorm, and I would go downstairs and sit and play and, of course, cry and make up songs, you know, all that kind of emotional angst. And somebody by the name of Paula Acacia came into the common area and said, Carol, I love the music you're playing. Do you write music? And I said, well, I can make up songs. And I just play down here like this. And she said, I want you to write the music to the sophomore show, which was the big showcase at Catholic University for theater majors in their sophomore year to present. And I wasn't even in the department. I was in the violin department. I felt like I could do anything. That was my father's influence.
What about the singing?
Singing, no, I was singing quietly to myself, and you know, people ridiculed me so much when I tried to sing. You know, growing up, I kept it to myself.
When does all this transform into performing arts?
I had to sing in the show that I wrote music for. They were like, oh, this is a great song. Carol, can you sing this? And I was like, I was trying to teach this to somebody. And the director said, you should sing it. We're going to create a scene for you in the show where everybody's at the Rathskeller. And you're going to pretend to be singing, performing at the Rathskeller. And that was the first time. And the head of the theater department heard me and saw me in the show. And was like, oh, I like her. And he always wanted me to be someplace in something, audition for something. Father Gilbert Harkey, he was the drama priest, I think they called him, or the theatrical priest. Well, when I was in Washington, D.C., I went to Catholic University on a violin performance scholarship. And I found, by the time I got to my sophomore year and I had done the soft show and I loved the theater people, I loved being in that atmosphere. It was more creative for me than being in the music department. I was the only black person in the music department, in the violin section, and the music was just wearing on me. The classical was wearing on me. I wanted some other things, and being in the theater department gave me that opportunity. So I started reading newspapers and seeing an audition. I saw an audition for the Black American Theater Company. They were doing a Langston Hughes play called The Prodigal Son.
In
Washington, D.C., and I got in. I had never auditioned for anything in my life. I mean, I'd never gone up and sang. I just wasn't, well, I was playing violin. But it turned out that I got in a play. I enjoyed doing that. That was a wonderful experience. The theater department kept calling me, Carol, come audition for this, audition for this. And they said, Father Harkey said, Carol, come and audition for the Germany tour. And I ended up auditioning for like an ensemble piece called The Best of Broadway. And we went to Germany on a USO tour. It turned out that because of these little experiences, they weren't little, but, you know, these various experiences, and with Father Harkey encouraging me, it turned out that when the call came out for the D.C. Black Repertory Theater Company in Washington, this is going to be a brand new ensemble. You're going to learn dance and singing and scene study and stagecraft. I went to audition. I auditioned like, I think, I must have auditioned three times. And I finally got into the first workshops for the summer of 71. And the theater kind of closed. They closed down for a while because they had to revamp. And finally, in 1972, I got back into the D.C. Black Repertory Company. They started again. Bernice Johnson Regan was the vocal director. Robert Hooks, he was the executive director. He was a very famous actor at the time. And Vantile Motajiko Whitfield was our artistic director, our teacher, our fearless leader, our guide. And
you kept composing?
No, I wasn't composing so much. I did that composing, I think, for the soft show, and then pretty much I was really just trying to find my way in the theater department. I ended up in the theater department thanks to Father Harkey after I didn't want to do music anymore. He said, come on, I'll give you a scholarship and a job. Come hang out in my office and, you know, do theater. Learn your craft. And that's what I did. But when I got in the D.C. Black Repertory Company, that was a whole, you know, I was preppy, base weejins, knee socks, little skirts and V-neck sweater. I went with the flow, I guess you could say. And back then, we're talking the 70s. So we're talking about everybody was loosey-goosey, and I had to find my way into being kind of not so uptight. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was just, like I said, I was a little preppy girl. And so I had to find my way into the African fabric and the head wrap and the little short afro and the culture. I had to learn, start to really, I knew stuff from high school, but I had to learn more and be more centered in myself as an African American artist.
Took you to walk to the White House.
Yes, yes, yes. Oh, that's true. Yeah, well, I think it was the first tour that we did. And we were invited, and Father Harkey always made sure that that group was invited to whoever was the White House person, because he was always hanging out there. So we had an opportunity to have tea with Miss Patricia Nixon at the time. So that must have been like 1970, 71 or 72 that we did that. Yeah.
How does a sweet honey come into your life?
Through the D.C. Black Repertory Theater Company.
But you're a founder. How did that happen?
Oh, well, because I was Bernice's, well, one thing, I was Bernice's vocal assistant in all of her classes. There was a gentleman by the name of Lee Tari, and Lee wanted us to have a vocal group. We had a dance company. We had a professional acting company. We had a senior workshop. And he thought we should have a vocal group because we were singing. It was beautiful music Bernice was teaching us as our vocal director. And he bugged her, and I mean he bugged her, until she finally said, okay, I'll put the group together.
Acapella? You did
acapella. Acapella was, because that's how we were trained in the theater. So we could be animals. We could be the wind. We could be the ocean.
How many people?
In the first group of singers, there were 10 of us. Men and women. Well, we did anything. We did church songs. We did sacred music, gospel, more spirituals than gospel. original music. We did pop. There was some pop things and R&B things that we would do. But every time we had a rehearsal, there was a different grouping of people. And Bernice got frustrated, and she said, okay, I'm going to call one more rehearsal and see who shows up. And it was me and my best friend Louise and another woman named Mai and Bernice. So she wasn't originally supposed to be in the group. She was putting it together. And even if no matter how many of us were there, it sounded great. But this last time in September, it was four of us, and we sang every song. Hey, let's sing this. We made up parts, and we sang and said, okay, this is Sweet Honey in the Rock, because in the early rehearsals when there were men in the group, the song that she taught us was Sweet Honey in the Rock, Sweet Honey in the Rock. It tastes like honey in the rock. So that was a song that we were all harmonizing, and ooh, this is cool. And so I said this would be a good name for the group.
What year?
1972. At that point, it was 73.
Did you start traveling?
No, no, no. No, we didn't start any of that until the fall of 73. We did our first performance. And Bernice had been very major in the civil rights movement as a singer with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And she was a part of a group called the Freedom Singers. They traveled. So she brought that sensibility to the work that we did once the four of us, the quartet, was formed. Yeah. And then we started, we started traveling in 74.
And the recording.
We did that, our first recording in 75 on Flying Fish Records, and released it in 76. And the group was also, what was very important, the Smithsonian wanted to have a series of events leading up to the bicentennial of the United States of America. In 1974, all of the outdoor festival that they did in the summer, that was 2 weeks. 75, it was a month. And in 76, it was 3 months of endless music, Americana, other countries coming in. It was phenomenal. And Sweet Honey was in that program every day for 2 weeks, every day for a month, every day for 3 months. Because Bernice was the artistic director of the African Diaspora Program. I was a field researcher. It was phenomenal. It was, I'll give you an example. So say, for instance, during the first week, we were dealing with the British influence in slavery. So we had Trinidad came because they were part of the British thing. And then there were certain states and cities that had that culture, the West African, Trinidadian, American, British feeling. So we had food, we had braiding, we had costumes, we had singing, we had everything. And every year every week there was a different grouping of people.
Did you record?
I think the Smithsonian did. I think they actually did. We recorded Sweet Honey did our first recording, I think mostly because we had all that time together singing.
Were you nominated then?
No, they weren't even looking at us. Our music is eclectic. It's not gospel, it's not pop, it's not R&B, but it has all of those elements.
About your personal life, tell me a little bit.
Well, I'll start from where I am right now. I live in New York City, and I'm the mother of a magnificent 32-year-old man who is a violinist as well, and also a music producer, and in the last 3 years has won 3 Grammys for his work out in Los Angeles, creating music and being, like I said, a producer. I just didn't think that would happen. I thought he was going to be a coach, a basketball coach, or a basketball writer, or a sports writer, or on television, as a newscaster. His music, he asked me when he was about 5 if he could play violin. I never talked a whole lot about that. I think his dad did. his father and I were separated. And I think Elliot used to talk about, oh, your mom plays, here's your mom's instrument, your mom played. And then one day Jordan was like, Mommy, can I learn how to play the violin? And at that period of time, that was not going to happen because, you know, financially and everything, it was just like a little too much. He ended up in an elementary school, Central Park East 1, that had a magnificent violin program called the, I think it was called the East Harlem Violin Program with Roberta Guaspare. They had been on television. They had been Isaac Stern. Yeah, Isaac Stern got up in there, and they ended up doing a film about her. There was a documentary called, you know, 50 Strings or something like that. But anyway, that he ended up in that program, and it took him, took his music. I mean, that's, but he wasn't even in an elementary school then. He was at Westside Montessori Preschool. And I said, one day, baby. Jordan was interesting because he learned in a group the same way I did, but he got into Juilliard. Some of the kids got into this summer, this MAP program, Music Apprentice Program, I think it was called, and they got violin lessons from Juilliard teachers every Saturday. And they had classes, they had ethnic music classes, they had voice class, they had everything. They had everything. And he stayed with it. So
has he performed with you?
Once. We've only done something together once after 9/11. Someone I know put together a program at the Ethical Culture School. And Jordan played, and then I sang a little bit, and then he played some more and finished. So, no, we haven't done too much together. We're very good friends. I always wanted to raise my son to be a good friend to anyone, but particularly to me. As I got older, I wanted him to know that it wasn't an obligation to be in my life or for us to be in each other's life, or what a great thing if we can be. But we're good buddies. We are good buddies. Came a lot of places. He went to Australia. He went to England. He went to New Zealand.
On your tours?
Mm-hmm. I took him with me because I wanted him to see the world. Plus, with this violin program, he's been to Switzerland. He's been to Germany. He's been to all these different places and been in films, on television, played with Madonna, Wyclef Jean, all these different people. So he has his own amazing story and legacy at his age of the different things. He takes up a lot of my love space, you know, in terms of just being aware but giving him space. Personally, you know, I raised him in, I have a guru, Guru Maestro Vilasananda. I practice Siddha Yoga meditation.
Still do?
Yeah. That's a big, major chunk of his life and my life. He doesn't practice, but he's aware. He teaches me. Remember, Mommy, blah, 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 blah. And I go, all right. I don't want to be, don't be upset, Mommy. You know, just zen out, just chill out. Mommy, go meditate. I don't think of myself as very disciplined, but I think probably as a performer I am. I always feel like I could do better with my health and better with my studies, different things I want to do. I think I'm transitioning it right now. Sweet Honey and the Rock started with a sign language interpreter back in 1980, Shirley Childress. And she traveled with the group. She was one of the few sign language interpreters for the deaf and hard of hearing. Because Sweet Honey, I wasn't with the group then, but they had been going to women's events, had been invited to these festivals, and women made it accessible for everybody to be at the show. If you had babies and you wanted to go to a concert without your children, you could leave your kids here. We'll take good care of your babies. If you were in a wheelchair, there were going to be ramps and places for you to sit. If you could not hear, or you could not hear or speak, and you needed sign language, that was accessible for you. And all of these events, I think, really influenced the group. And when Shirley joined, she was a sign language interpreter for 35 years until she passed.
And you still have that.
We have a new sign language interpreter, Barbara Hunt.
who I met at Catholic University of America, was one of my, you know, co-student people. Right now, we're trying to make it happen to go to Moldova in Eastern Europe. We're not sure how that's going to work out, but that's the only invitation that's there right now. And we're going to be performing in Montgomery, Alabama, for a really, really important museum opening. There is a remembrance museum for lynching and slavery, and also there's a remembrance museum for the history of what people in the South and what we went through from slavery to now mass incarceration as a systematic assault on the African-American male community. Yes.
What about the Grammys for the group?
Yeah, the Grammys, it's interesting because Sweet Honey has not received a Grammy of her very own.
How's that?
Because we have gotten Grammys for being part of other compilations. Celebration, there's a woman, Ella Jenkins. When she was 50 years old, she decided she was going to start teaching babies music, teaching children music. And they did a celebration of her life and she was 85. She's still out there singing. We just did something for her a couple of years ago and she still had a little baby ukulele and she was just singing and she's quite phenomenal. I think she may have slowed down a little bit. Right now, I just can't imagine myself not being a performing artist. I was blessed, as you've mentioned, just guided and blessed and, my ancestors and Orishas and guardians knew my purpose and supported me in finding ways to make it happen. Sometimes I think I could have listened a little better and said yes a little bit more and gone with this, that, or the other thing, even though it was uncomfortable. I might have learned something else from that. I've been really, really fortunate. I'm single. I like being by myself. I've lived in my apartment on the Upper West Side for over 40 years. It's manageable. It turned out that the traveling, this was a great place to have for my work and taking care of my son, taking him on the road with me, teaching him, learning with him, being a part. He's such a major part of why I am who I am today. In addition to my meditation and my spiritual practices, growing up the way I did, I'm still standing, Gilda. I'm still here. And I don't ever want to stop being a performing artist.
I've been very, very fortunate in many ways. And I have gone through a lot. I think my main problem that I have over and over again that I'm still trying to examine is my finances and being able to maintain. I live on 83rd Street and I love my apartment. I would like to be able to move because I can, not because I can't afford to. All the work that I do and all that I offer, I know there's still so much more I could give, so much more I could teach. I don't want to be a teacher, but so much more I could coach. Different ways that I could tell people this story of mine from being a little girl twirling on 15th Street and not really having a lot of people understanding this thing that I said, I want to be an actress.
You have good friends that help.
Oh, my friends. Now, that's a whole nother video, Gilda. My friends? Lord Jesus. I wouldn't be able to be here if it wasn't for them. I would not. They are my treasure, the friends that I have. I have friends. Well, I had a friend. He passed last year that I had known since I was 8. And Robert and I were like, I don't even have that. What's the tightest word you can have? He's my brother. He was like my brother.
Spiritual brother.
Yeah. When we met, we were like, ooh. Crystal, we friends, and we stayed friends. We lose each other, find each other, lose each other, and we were found together, and he died last May. My friends from the D.C. Black Repertory Theater Company, There are a whole lot of us. There's over 30, 35, 40 of us. But there are at least, I mean, in my intimate sphere, there's a good 15, 20 men and women who are in my, we are, you know, locked in like that. I have a friend that I've known since I was 12, Bernadette. We met at Operation Discovery in Philadelphia, which is a special program for smart kids in parochial school. Wild bunch. One summer of wild living, writing, traveling, being hippies, and the whole nine yards of it. It was fabulous. No, I'm not alone. I don't have a partner. I'm not looking for one. I'm fine not having one.
Carol Lynn, or as a child you were called?
Lenny.
They still call you that?
Yeah, I got cousins that still say, hey, Lenny.
Before we wrap, you just came back from a trip. Is that correct?
I just came back. Oh, yeah, yeah. Boston. Just did a concert in Boston and another one in Alexandria, Virginia. Been on tour for about 5 weeks. Sweet Honey and the Rock's last two recordings. The most recent one from 2016 is called Hashtag Love in Evolution. And we wanted to talk about love as an action word, something that you do, not something necessarily that you just feel or express, but love for your community, for God, for yourself, for your family. And this other one I wanted you to have, because it's a jazz recording, and it's called, I have to read it, I forgot what it's called, Sweet Honey and the Rock, a tribute. And this is a tribute to Nina Simone, Abby Lincoln, Miriam Makeba, and Odetta. So these are their songs, and they were artists and activists. And that's very much where Sweet Honey and the Rock is. We are artists who are activists and socially conscious. So the music is, it's a beautiful recording, a lot of love songs, and we do it with a trio. We have a jazz trio. Nice. We got piano, bass, and drums on this recording, and on Love and Evolution, we have a bass player with. There are five singers working right now, a sign language interpreter, and a bass player who's male, a young man. The next trip is when we go to Montgomery, Alabama, for the opening of the museum. Actually, before that, we're going to do a joint project for the D.C. Jazz Commission. And we're going to be working with some South African performers and teaching teachers how to teach music to kids.
You don't feel old. You feel young.
You would just say with you, Gilda. How else are we going to be? I don't even know any other way to be. I think about it. I go like, what would it feel like for me to feel, what does it feel like to feel older? I just feel like me. I feel like I'm 24. I feel better than I felt when I was 16. I feel better than I felt when I was 9 or 10. I would say I give myself a 95 because I need to do better. Always doing better.
Thank you so much.
You're a blessing. Gilda. God bless. My girl. Gilda Mendez. I'm really honored to be a part of this amazing program, the Performing Arts Legacy, sponsored by the Actors Fund of America. It gives me an opportunity not only to do a look back over everything that I've done as a performing artist, but looking forward, I want to be able to share this information with young performers who may not have an opportunity to know older performers, people who have been really seasoned, people who have done a lot of different kinds of work in this industry. I want you to know that your gift and your light are so unique to your own being, and that you should always know that whatever it is that your spirit tells you to do, you should go forward. I want to act. I want to sing. I want to write. I want to be behind the scenes. And don't let people discourage you, because people who don't understand, they don't know what to say. Most of the time, it's beyond their comprehension that a person would want to put themselves out into the world creatively. We get judged, we get critiqued, we get rejected, we get told no a lot. Do you know what kind of a strong spirit one has to have to be able to do that and to continue on and to still say, I love my craft, I love what it is that I do and what God has given me to offer. So continue on. Don't be discouraged. Find new ways to express your creativity, because sometimes you may think it's about the acting, but it might be about the writing. You might need to write a little bit so you could act a little better, so you could learn more, but really study your craft, hone your gift. Always put yourself out there with abandon and with an open, giving heart. Because I think if you get to the point where you're judging yourself up against other people, you are not going to do very well. You're going to be unhappy. You're going to stop doing what you do. You're going to not do it and wonder at some point when you're 45 or even 35, oh, I wish I had a. You always can, you always should, and you always will be a blessed, blessed asset to the whole universe if you give from your heart and give it honestly. And again, I want to thank the Actors Fund for this marvelous opportunity, and all the best to all of you. God bless. Thank you.